Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon to all my blessed beloveds out there in Radio Land. You're listening to Living and Thriving with Rusty, and guess what? I'm Rusty. Even when I'm awake, I'm a little rusty, and yes, sometimes I do squeak. But today is Sunday, the absolute fun day. My daughter and I decided to randomly and spontaneously go and participate in the Maple Weekend here in New England. So we drove an hour south to a place that we've never actually participated in Sunday, and we get to the farm. It's jam-packed with people, and there's no maple syrup, no maple candy, no maple anything, actually. So with sad faces, we start pulling out of the driveway, and I didn't want to hit a young lady, so I stopped and told her to go on past, and because of that, she gave us the last maple candy that was shaped like a moose. It was amazing. It was so sweet. And so Chloe gave me an antler, and I was able to appreciate a little bit of spring syruping here in New England with a moose, maple moose antler. Don't say that too fast. And as we actually started out on our journey, I stopped at my favorite Bucks of Star, and our place in the drive-thru, and Lord and behold, somebody had paid for our beverages. Amen. What a grateful day. We got free beverages. We got a free maple moose head. I know it sounds weird, but it's just a maple candy. And we came home, and Lord and behold, little fairies had left some baseball equipment for my daughter, because she's going to be doing softball here in about a week and a half. And it just was a very receiving day. So I'm grateful, and I'm humbled, and I'm just in love with the universe. Yesterday, as I was driving, I was having some fearful thoughts, because they exist, even for those of us who are incredibly optimistic. Every now and then, we have a fearful thought or two. What makes us a little bit more unique is that we recognize that that's what these thoughts are, and we do our best to correct them. And so I'm having these fearful thoughts and recognizing that's what they are. And I look up and I see this license plate, and it says FLA-BN as in Nancy, D as in dog. And I'm scratching my head and I'm going, Florida band? What is a Florida band license plate doing up here in New Hampshire? And then I said, oh, Lord Jesus, thank you. It's Florida bound. As in Chloe and I are bound for Florida. That was a universal message. It just put an extra step in my walk for the rest of the day, because the universe gives you messages. You just have to be attuned and ready and able to hear them. Tonight, I am so grateful to have Dr. Craig Weiner on. He is a licensed psychologist and author of many books, and he actually talks about a subject that I most personally have experience with my bonus child. She had ADHD. That's a tough subject, and unfortunately, as a parent of a bonus child with ADHD, it's a battle. It wasn't a battle when I was teaching special ed many, many years ago. I don't want to tell you how old I am. Oh, you already know. Never mind. But now it's even more of a battle to try to get resources and understanding in the school system with ADHD. So I'm really looking forward to talking to him and learning more about it. As you know, I am looking for sponsors. We have grown so rapidly that in one weekend, Karen has received over 300 guest requests to be on this show. How grateful am I? Thank you so much for the love and the support. I am grateful and appreciative. But we need sponsors. So we opened up Sunday night for about a half an hour, and it is what it is. We're here. If you want our shows, I need the sponsors to do so. I have to pay Karen to do what she does, and she's fabulous. And Blog Talk Radio is not free more than a half an hour. So go to RustyMacDonald.com, hit the sponsorship page, and it's $1 to $10,000 billion. And it's not Monopoly money. It's actually real Uncle Sam dollars. But, you know, donate what you can. Help Living and Thriving grow and continue. Also, as you know, I will be on Jennifer Hill's TV show this week 3 times. I think it was Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at 4:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We taped back before my birthday in February in regards to life and what matters in life. It's pretty amazing. So go to P as in Paul, M as in Mary, TV, New Hampshire, NH.org, and check us out. We'll be on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, airing at 4:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you want to sponsor, this is the place where I would plug you in. And Blog Talk actually is giving us 54 minutes, so this is beautiful today. So here it is.
Tune in weekly to Living and Thriving with Rusty, Inspiration on Tap. Rusty explores topics related to mind, body, and soul. For more information, go to her site at rustymcdonald.com. Not McDonald like the farmer, or certainly not like the fast food. Rusty McDonald, just what the doctor ordered. Listen to Living and Thriving with Rusty, Inspiration on Tap. Tune in weekly to Living and Thriving with Rusty, life coach, radio talk show host, single mom, and blogger.
Oh, Lordy, I love that commercial. He is so funny. He's a funny person in person, too. So you're listening to Living and Thriving with Rusty. We have Dr. Craig Warner on. The number here, if you want to call in and ask questions, because he's just a plethora of knowledge, is 347-205-9443. So, Dr. Weiner, how are you?
I'm fine. Hi. You had a lucky day, it sounds like.
Oh, my gosh, it was such a blessing. It was one of those one, two, three punches, but in just a positive universal light. So I was really grateful.
Yeah.
Except minus the syrup. I was pretty upset about that. I do love real maple syrup, not the imitation syrup or flavored with imitation syrup. It has to be real from the trees. There's nothing like it. I was disappointed. And so, Dr. Weiner, can you give us an idea of who you are and what you do?
Well, yeah, I've been a clinical psychologist for 35 years, and I have a private practice. I'm clinical director at a primary care facility for over 20 years and assistant professor at University of Massachusetts Medical School.
And so you're local here. I didn't realize you were close to home. Very cool. Well, high five. You've indulged in this stunning and incredulous winter as well.
Exactly.
I actually, when we had that huge blizzard that blocked out D.C., I was driving from my house in Florida through D.C., and my GPS didn't take us around D.C. It took us through D.C. We were the only car going in downtown D.C. a couple of weeks ago, and I was waiting for the zombies to come out. Okay, Washington, D.C., no cars but us. This is not right. There's something wrong here. It's crazy. It's been a crazy winter. So tell us a little bit about what you wanted to be when you grew up as a kid. What kind of kid were you?
I always liked sports, and I was an active kid. Maybe that's one of the reasons why I was interested in this diagnosis, because it was affecting so many boys, and especially boys that may be more active than other kids. So, And I grew up, my father's a psychologist, professor at Clark University, so I grew up with psychology.
Mm-hmm. So you were a sports fanatic and psychology, and you were kind of just, were you a bouncing off the wall kind of kid?
No, just like sports, like to be active. Like we played, you know, those are the days where you played all day in the neighborhood, baseball, basketball, football.
So. Yeah, when it started to get a little dusky, you'd come inside because it was supper time. Nowadays you can't do that.
Exactly.
There's just more heebie-jeebies out there than there used to be. Or at least, you know, we see them more. So your father was a psychologist. What did your mom do?
She was a sculptor, an artist. So it had an artist for my mother and a scientist for a father.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And what got you into psychology? You just said...
Well, as I said, my father's a psychologist, so I kind of learned it all the way through. And I enjoyed it, and I knew my father enjoyed being a psychologist, and I just kind of got into it based on exposure, interest. My friends always found it easy to talk with me, so it encouraged me to get into clinical psychology.
Clinical psychology was very difficult. I did not, and every class is based on easy or difficult nature, you know, depending on the teacher. And my clinical psychology class was gruesome. How did you get through it? Did you have a great teacher? Or?
Oh, as I say, I got exposed to this stuff from a very early age. By the time I was in grad school, I was way ahead of the curve. Just it's the same thing as if a kid who's father's a professional baseball players, they get exposed to things that other kids aren't. It's kind of an inheritance. So
right.
It gets easier based on the exposure you have.
Very cool. So talk to us a little bit about what ADHD is, why you chose to focus your skill set to ADHD, and is it really, let me see, one of the myths that came across my email was it's not a medical condition, it's just bad parenting. So,
okay, so what I've come to believe is that you can't really blame the kid or the parent because a lot of kids are more difficult than other kids to socialize, and a lot of kids from the ADHD diagnosis were difficult to socialize based on health problems, motor problems, language problems, learning problems, negative infant temperament. Now there's a lot. Now that just means that there's a increased probability of kind of evolving into this behavioral pattern based on those starting points. But there are kids with ADHD diagnosis without those starting points. And, you know, it's always an interaction of a particular child in the particular world that they're living in. So some kids will respond to the same environment in different ways. So I kind of get away from the notion of how to blame people. But what I do believe is that the behaviors do get reinforced, not on purpose, but that the behaviors that we call ADHD multiply and increase based on, because they become ways of coping, they become a child or an adult's eventual solution to problems and adversity. You know, these behaviors don't occur when the person is doing something they initiate and enjoy. They occur when the person's responding to a situation that's associated with negativity, loss of discretionary authority, failure, disapproval, restriction. These are behaviors that go with certain situations and circumstances. So I study interactions of when the kids do these behaviors and what happens when they do these behaviors, and I help parents and the individual learn to do different behaviors in response to the problems they encounter in the world.
So I personally, when I connected with my ex-husband, he was a father of a child, and I started raising her when she was two. And she had a series of issues. And thank God my degree's in psychology. You know, so I was able to navigate a little bit through it more easily than I think regular parents. And I was not able to have her tested, even though we knew, until she was 8 years old. So there's a theory that not only ADHD is a myth, but it's also based on bad parenting, but it doesn't affect girls. She's almost 20 now, and it's she had the adversarial type of ADHD. Talk to us a little bit about that type of research and why they only consider it a gender-specific, or why the myths are gender-specific.
Well, it used to be three boys to every one girl, but you know the ratios are changing, and boys are more likely to be motor active, so they do more of the behaviors that go with hyperactivity, or the behaviors that they call impulsive, which really are just desperate behaviors or intrusive behaviors or behaviors that create problems for other people. And females typically do the distracted behaviors, because I call them avoidance responses. So that but as the genders learn to be blended, the polarity of male behaviors and female behaviors seems to be disappearing to some extent. So you're getting more and more females diagnosed over time. But of course, the population of ADHD kids is going higher and higher and higher every year. It's up to 11% now.
Crazy. When we were growing up, I don't know how old you are. I'm 380. I just turned 380 years old. And when I was growing up, ADHD did not exist. And I grew up in the South. So if you were problematic, or if you were a naughty child, or if you had any kind of impulsivity, they'd beat the hell out of it. And you would end up being submissive in military format. And, gosh, I want to say when I started college, no, actually when I started high school, that's when I started hearing about ADHD and ADD. What was really the pivotal moment in regards to psychology that allowed us to understand that it's just not naughty children who, you know, can't follow rules? It genuinely is a disorder that needs to be worked with. It's not always easy, but it can happen.
So the problem is with the advent of medications and the genome era, where they study the body with brain scans and brain studies and genetic studies, molecular biology, a lot of people interpret this data as if it's creating a causality for the biology. So that all these diagnoses, there's so many more diagnoses since I started, they're all correlated with what a particular drug, or somebody does research that says somebody's body is different than somebody else's body who does those behaviors. They look at the brains of ADHD kids, but they take it to be a cause. But when you think about it, your brain is only a function of what you've already learned to do in the world. So that if you're a cab driver in London, they find out that your visual spatial cortex is larger and more differentiated than people who don't drive the cab. So if you're a child and you do ADHD behaviors, your course brain isn't going to develop the same way as if you were learning to function differently in the world. So people take a lot of this data as if it's establishing biological causality. And then with the drugs, that people justify taking the drug by this biological data.
Well, and I have to tell you, just from experiencing the adversarial ADHD side, and it was really, really tough, but being who I am, which is more organic, naturopathic person, it was really a struggle for many years, because there are many components that you're dealing with as a parent, or as a bonus parent. In my case, it was even harder, because biologically I wasn't connected to this child. So you're dealing with hormones, which increase by the age of 13, 1,200%. You know, they're skyrocketing with their estrogen and progesterone and testosterone at that age. So they're already chemically, you know, a soup or a stew. They're just chemically juicing in a major way. Then you have the educational, emotional development piece of desiring independence, wanting to push, pull, and separate, yet hold on, that process of the change. And now you have ADHD, which I truly believe synaptically has neurologically has a huge impact on the development as they grow up. So what is the science that supports that, and how do parents like me who prefer not to medicate, would prefer a more organic way, treat their child? In my particular case, all of the medicine that was being offered at that time would actually make a very skinny, unusually skinny child even skinnier. So we couldn't put her on the medicine without potentially putting her in a malnutrition, malabsorption place, which is what got me into the whole naturopathic methods. So what is the evidence, and how do parents navigate through this?
Yeah, so that's what I was, that's what I'm trying to help parents with is, well, there's several important points there. Is that, first of all, the kids who were, they're finding out now, the kids who are on the Ritalin or the stimulants are actually having more obesity in adolescence, because I think it changes your response to food, and also you have to kind of worry about whether the child is eating or not, so it changes the whole interaction around food. But they don't really know particularly why, but they're now finding some problems with the uses of these stimulants. Also, the studies are showing that after 6 years of the Johns Hopkins study, among many, are showing that the ADHD kids who are medicated aren't doing any better than the untreated kids, so that the parents really require another kind of intervention in the long term, even though in the short term these medications seem to work beautifully. Now, as I was saying to you, the medical, the biological, there's no biology that says you have ADHD. There's plenty of people with whatever genes that slightly increase your chances of evolving into this pattern. There's plenty of people who are diagnosed ADHD without those genes. There's plenty of identical twins who one twin ADHD and the other one isn't, and it's just a starting place, the biology. The youngster you were raising and the adversarial stuff, this is exactly what I'm trying to help parents do, because you can train, the typical ADHD method is medication and then try to control the child or compensate to offset the ADHD. The problem is the child doesn't learn really to self-manage under these systems. It's really like raising your child, like you were saying, an army metaphor, where you almost train them in an institution. You can get a kid to comply, but how do you get a kid to learn to be independent and manage on their own? So that's what I'm trying to help parents with. It's a very different way to help the child develop.
So let's step it back and let's just go down to, you know, psychology 101. And talk very simple. So what we're to understand is that there's not a genetic DNA, you know, tier 7, number 43 on the B side of your genome, that little crazy curly Q that has all of our technical information as though we're a computer. There's nothing there that says you have ADHD or ADD back in the old days. Now we're just ADHD. It used to be ADD or ADHD.
Yeah.
So there's nothing, you can't get a fingerprint that says
that's right.
You have, or a blood test or anything like that. There's not a physical, biological, chemical trace marker flag that says you have ADHD.
That's correct.
Correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
But
so
your starting point, what's that?
Chances that ADHD is actually an environmental occurrence is pretty high. Is that correct?
Let me see if I can get people to think about it differently. Your starting point, though, changes your probability of what you learn. If you're very tall, you're more likely to learn to play basketball if you're coordinating and tall. If you're very good-looking. What's that?
Okay. I said, don't start that. I was very tall, and that was one of my biggest pet peeves, because everybody growing up in the South, they're like, you were so tall. You need to play basketball. And from there, I hated basketball.
That's right. So it doesn't fit. That's a beautiful example, because even though you may have a higher probability of doing the basketball, you didn't. So a lot can change, and a lot affected whether you did or didn't do it. if you're,
but that was
if
a behavioral response, I think. So is that what you're trying to say? So for me, I was already obstinate about the concept of trying basketball because nobody – I was a nerd. I was born a nerd. I was born with encyclopedias in my diaper. So when people degraded, in my mind, degraded me into being a basketball player, not to say that it's a degradation of any sort, just in my mind at the time, it was very degrading. It's like, you're going to be a model, you're going to play basketball. Those are the only two things I heard when I was growing up. Do you think that that would have been a trigger to have a learning disability?
I don't know. You had a particular reaction to coercion or to expectation, or you felt it meant something, so you had a particular response to it. Now, another person who was tall and attractive may have had a different response to these things that people were saying. But you can still see it's a psychological problem. It's not the same thing as treating somebody with diabetes. The psychology is involved with this ADHD thing.
Cool. That's I'm cornering you for a reason. All right. So it's environmental. It's psychological. What are the other potential factors that are outside of the DNA construct that people could kind of relate to? Would alcohol and drug abuse in infancy, what do they call it? Alcohol?
Well, fetal alcohol syndrome?
Yeah, that one.
Well,
that
because
that be
any,
one?
Because any time you have a lower probability of success, you'd have an increased probability of less success in the world. You have more avoidance behaviors, and you're less likely to become involved with the expectations of others in the same way as people who are successful. If you have a depressed mother, you're going to have all sorts of different social learning than if your mother's not depressed. You may learn, one kid may learn to be intrusive just to get the attention. One may learn to be parentified because the parent's not. One may copy the mother. One may do opposite the mother. But there's still a change in social patterning depending on what your parents do and who you are, your constitution, your initial constitution, and what happens to you as you develop. And this ADHD behaviors, these are intrusive behaviors and avoidant behaviors, basically. And they get reinforced unwittingly as the child lives in the world.
Well, and I can tell you at 380 years of age and still studying, I find it intriguing that recently, and I'm saying recently in the sense of public recency, we now have a distinguishing marker called ADHD versus executive dysfunction. Yet, symptomatically, they're very much Siamese twins. So can you talk a little bit about executive dysfunction and the similarities?
Executive functioning is much like self-management. So is that something that somebody can learn or can't learn or can learn, or somebody learns at a lower rate than somebody else, but you don't even know why they're doing or not doing self-management? A lot of these kids are from the very beginning may have gotten into a pattern where the parents were cueing them and doing for them, or if you're resisting expectations and resisting things that people want you to do, you're also going to have a skill deficit over time because you're not doing it. So if you're not doing your homework and then you're not doing your classwork, you're falling further and further behind. So just by the fact that people test you and say you're not managing situations in terms of these particular behaviors we call executive functioning behaviors doesn't mean that you're unable to. It means you're not doing it. So the problem is, why aren't you doing it, and why are you behind others in those areas? And the explanation for people's behavior isn't always that you have a deficit or defect or disruption or something wrong with you. It could be that you haven't yet learned it, or there's something else interfering with you learning it.
So let's say, hypothetically, and we're going to go to a quick break, but let's say hypothetically, the household was extremely caustic, and there was mild forms of verbal and emotional abuse, not necessarily physical, but as you know and I know extremely well, that you don't actually have to touch somebody to break them. And the child starts and this is something that used to drive me crazy as a paraeducator, paraprofessional is what you all call them down here. The child starts acting out, and not in the sense of acting out in a bad way, but just having behavioral differences. Mm-hmm. They're automatically coined as ADHD.
Yeah.
What are, and you and I both know that there's ADHD, it could be food allergies, they could physically be having some disruption in the body that's causing them to be tired and impulsive because they're uncomfortable but not able to articulate that. You and I both know that they could have schizophrenia or a tumor or multiple sclerosis. Like there's 3,000-4,000 possibilities, but we tend to jump right down and say, the child has ADHD, Medicaid.
Well, that's why it's 11% of the kids now. Once you get this behavior pattern identified, people see every problem in that light, in that framework.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's just marketing? Do you think that we're so inundated with marketing and our pharmaceutical companies are so pushy and aggressive about putting the latest and greatest, you know, $200 drug out in the market? Do you think that's why people are only educated to one particular possibility versus,
I think,
you know,
that,
what are your thoughts as a professional?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that that's one component. I think people have a wish for an elixir or a
right.
fountain of youth, and they have a wish to be hugged by their mommy and have somebody make their life better. And if somebody holds out, then people also have a wish that they're a victim of something rather than they're doing something. People
right.
don't want to deal with that they're doing. This is a coping thing. It's not a habit. It's a do it. It doesn't mean that I'm not sensitive to a person's struggles that they're doing these behaviors, but I try to help them empower them that they can also learn to do something different to cope with adversity or difficulties or lack of attention, lack of success. Criticism, failure. These are kids that are learning to avoid situations that go with failure. It's better not to try than to fail.
Very cool. So we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Living and Thriving with Rusty. I am so excited about having Dr. Craig Weiner on tonight's show because ADHD has affected my household, but being who I am and being the little geek that I tend to be, I find that ADHD tends to just be a mask or a cover-up for individuals who don't want to delve further and actually do the work, which is what these kids need and adults need is for people to help them do the work. We're going to go to a quick break and call in. This is a great topic, great conversation. The number here is 347-205-9443. And, you know, if you want to be a sponsor, this is the place where you would have your moments.
Tune in weekly to Living and Thriving with Rusty, Inspiration on Tap. Rusty explores topics related to mind, body, and soul. For more information, go to her site at rustymcdonald.com. Not McDonald like the farmer, or certainly not like the fast food. Rusty McDonald, just what the doctor ordered. Listen to Living and Thriving with Rusty, Inspiration on Tap. Tune in weekly to Living and Thriving with Rusty, life coach, radio talk show host, single mom, and blogger.
Hey, 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 it's Sunday night here at Living and Thriving Land, and I have one of the best guests on the planet. I'm so thrilled, and I didn't realize he was so close. So now I'm going to have to go and find him and give him a big old hug because we seem to be very symbiotic with this conversation. We do have a guest that just called in. Hello, caller.
Hi, Rusty. This is Sarah Hart.
Hey, my friend. I love you. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
This is like the perfect show for you.
Well, that's what I saw the notification on my email, and I said, I have to actually see what this guy's talking about, and it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, he's pretty fabulous. So why don't you tell him who you are, because you and I are friends, so it's a little different, but and then ask your question.
Well, hi, Dr. Warner. My name is Sarah Hart. I'm a local Dover, New Hampshire educator and shamanic practitioner. My life is kind of focused, well, not kind of, definitely focused on working with kids who have been identified as having behavioral or emotional disorders. I run a behavioral program in a small rural district near here, and my passion in life is sort of bridging the gap because in schools, we do things a certain way, and a lot of that is dependent on, you know, has the student taken their medication, has the student not taken their medication. But I know from my experience that that's really not what we need to be focusing on. And so I saw in the blurb that Rusty had on her website that you were working with helping students and kids and people find ways to be self-reliant and to use that to address behaviors that, you know, we all identify as maybe ADHD-like behaviors. But, you know, from working in the behavior program, I know that there's a lot of behaviors that people could benefit from being empowered with and being self-reliant. And that's sort of what I want to do in my shamanic work and my personal life with kids. So I was just wondering, you know, what recommendations do you have for somebody who's working in a school system, who's trying to make a difference and who's trying to move beyond this model of, you know, well, what are we going to do with this kid today, and he doesn't have his medicine, and what's going on, you know?
Well, yeah, that's great. That sounds exciting. One of the problems is going to be, as a teacher, you have to kind of deal with people in groups. And I think that one of the important problems for, I think, kids in general is going to be, are we losing the idea of how do you function in groups? Because one-on-one, each person can accommodate to each other in a very specific way, but once you get a group of three or four or five, there's a kind of a diminishment of the individual, and there's a requirement to learn how to do group behavior, which is you're not the focus of attention, and you have to accommodate to the group agenda. And
mm-hmm.
as a teacher, that's the real problem, because kids are coming from families a lot of times where there's not enough practice in how to participate amongst groups of people and learn to attend and add to what the theme of the group is, know when it's your turn to
mm-hmm.
These are subtle behaviors, it's called social skill stuff that kids are not learning the way they used to play in groups. There was a lot more group, even games, before than now with all the screens. You can just control the screen. You don't have to deal with coordinating with something. So
mm-hmm.
I think that that's a real issue. And the other thing is, am I on the right track for you? Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah, you know, well, because groups, that's a lot of my passion, you know. That's what I see the need is, and, you know, in the shamanic work, is like, okay, how can I get kids in an environment where they have to work on group skills? How can I do things in an adventure, outdoor, you know, based setting? But again, that's my work outside of school. So in school, even, you know, we're working on building talking circles and teaching the turn taking and teaching the interaction and those subtle behaviors that they need to learn to even just accept the fact that they're not the center of attention all of the time, but that they're still important.
Yes. So that's the kind of thing, and that how do we help parents also learn to do the same kind of thing at home, so when the kid goes to school, they're school ready.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
But don't hang up yet, Sarah, because I actually have a powerful question for both of you, being on either ends of the spectrum, yet doing the same type of work. However, I'm a parent, and I'm one of those nosy parents that I like to talk to my daughter's teacher all the time. I email my daughter's teacher every week. Hey, how's she doing? How was her behavior? How was her attitude? I love my kid. I go to every field trip that I can. I have one that's turning 20, so, God, I'm getting old. But there is this feeling, at least in this area, I find extremely annoying, and you and I were talking about it over chai the other day. A lot of these schools feel that parents' interaction and involvement is actually a nuisance. And there are very few, and you and I were talking about this the other night, there are very few parents who are involved. But I find it very intimidating when teachers are like, why do you care what your kid's reading? Because I'm a parent. So if you have a child with ADHD and you're trying to collaboratively work on behavioral issues so that they can, you know, survive, but you have this mentality or this attitude that the parent is just a nuisance, how do parents combat that? Because it's a very real thing.
It is a real thing, and hopefully I'm not butting in, Dr. Warner. But from my perspective as a teacher working with kids who have a number of challenging behaviors, is that I need my parents. I need them so much. And the reason why is, you know, it's so difficult for kids with challenging behaviors to be at school and learn one way to do things and then go home and learn a different way to do things and then maybe go to the softball field and learn a different way to do things. And if we're working on those skills like Dr. Warner was talking about, like the group skills and those subtle behaviors, then I need to be able to communicate with parents like, hey, this is what we're working on. And I need parents to communicate with me like, hey, that thing you're working on, it's not working for home. Or, hey, that's working great for home. Because it's about building this continuum of care and continuum of support. And I'm very much an early childhood educator, very family-based, you know, even though I work with older kids. And I just feel like, well, plus from a shamanic perspective, it's all about the community and all about the family system, right? So you've got to be able to connect with people and connect with parents. And honestly, you know what? I can take a parent who calls a lot and who texts a lot and who wants to know how their kid is doing much easier than I can take a parent that doesn't talk to me at all. I can work with a lot of talking. I can't work with you if you can't don't talk to me at all. So I feel like that communication is so very important. What advice I have to give for parents who are seeing resistance in that area, I don't know, because I wish so much for parents to talk to me that I don't know. I would just say, please, you know, keep talking or find the right person to talk to, because there's somebody out there who wants to hear and wants to support your child and wants to listen. So that's what I was thinking.
So Dr. Warner, explain to me what your perspective as a clinical psychologist is in regards to that, because there are who are not involved, and then there are the evidently, unfortunately, what I've been told is I'm a rare parent who is involved, and what is your perspective on your end?
Well, what I like to do is have everybody understanding what it is we're trying to shape and train. And sometimes parents can relay to teachers some of the things that they do that are working, especially if they're in therapy. If it's in therapy with me, we like to make sure the teacher's aware of some of the things we're discovering or finding out, that maybe this youngster's sensitive to there's failure rates, and how do you get them to respond to their mistakes differently, or what the child's interests are that the teacher then can pick up on in class. If the kid is into wrestlers or Pokemon or something, maybe there's a thing that the teacher can do to help. Everybody's trying to get a relationship with the kid that would promote the youngster's involvement and excitement about learning. So whatever people can do. One of the problems, though, that we don't really have with the kind of work you're doing is that a lot of the schools, they say, are really responsible for the huge increase in these diagnoses because of the No Child Left Behind thing. So that they did some studies that showed that the states that had adopted this early on had tripled the rates of ADHD, and then as the states picked up these laws, the rates of ADHD then went up in those states. And the idea is that if you get a diagnosis, you can, the kids' scores got off the responsibility of the schools, and the kid can't get a special program unless they have a diagnosis. So, and then you have the problem of
I have to interrupt, Dr. Warner, because having a child who was part of in. She was kind of in the middle of that whole, and I will say, redonkulous, inappropriate, unsuccessful, and terribly discriminatory act, No Child Left Behind. That's my personal opinion. It has nothing to do with anybody else on the show. That's me. I had to actually fight legislation, go all the way up to Augusta, Maine, where the senators and all those types of folks are hanging out, to fight for my bonus child to have a 501 plan so that she could get resources, because she was diagnosed with ADHD and emotional dysfunction plus depression, but ADHD was not covered under the No Child Left Behind Act. It wasn't considered a disability. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to interrupt you on that, because that was my personal experience, and it took me 18 months and literally having to go in front of the Senate going, really? Are you kidding me? I'm a feisty redhead. I'm not going anywhere. I got nothing better to do. I've got at least another 100 years in my lifetime. I'm going to sit here in your office until you let my daughter get the help that she needs. And that was because of the No Child Left Behind Act. So I don't necessarily feel that ADHD was increased because of that. Well,
how many years ago was
a,
how many years ago were you going through that?
Oh God, it was right when that thing all happened. She will be 20 in October.
Yeah.
She was born
yeah.
in 94. So
yeah.
like it was just, she was kind of in the middle of that whole bloodshed. I don't know if that's
yeah.
changed since, but
well,
you have no idea the hell I went through to get her help.
Yeah, that's according to these studies, that's what they're saying. So whatever's changed has changed with that.
Yeah.
Ooh,
yeah,
that
it's increased. Well, one thing I know from just to share a little bit of what goes on in the schools in this area, I know that many schools consider themselves response to intervention schools. So from a special education perspective, yes, you know, when you are looking for kids, you find kids, right? You know, a hand doctor sees hands. Well, if you're looking for kids, you know, with
right.
disabilities, you're going to find kids with disabilities. But at the same time, there are kids out there that, you know, don't have diagnoses but do need help, and they have behaviors that are, for example, ADHD-like behaviors, but they don't have anything official from the doctor's office to say, hey, you know, this kid needs A504 or this kid needs an IEP. So what do? Well, response to intervention, and I think that's even calling it something different now, is this philosophy that, well, if we can, as a school, build in different tiers of support and different tiers of intervention, maybe we can address that student's needs without it having to go to a special ed referral. But again, you know, it's just looking at that individual and seeing what we can offer them and really looking at them in a unique way and trying to meet their needs as a school-wide system. But every school is different is the thing. So, you know, one school system might have some supports while the others don't. But the response to intervention movement has been pretty interesting to follow, and I do think we make a really good effort at least trying to help the kids out. But, you know, I do also think that the data, yeah, I can see what you're saying too, Dr. Warner. And Rusty, there's a lot of sides to it, you know.
It's very skewed, and unfortunately it's doing a disjustice to all of us because there's you, Sarah, who's actually in the pit of trying to encourage and enable, but being disabled in your own right as an educator because you're only allowed to do so much per whatever sanctions, whether it's political or, you know, scientific outreach. And then there's Dr. Werner here, who's a clinical psychologist who's been doing this for 35 years, and he's seen the transgressions and the, you know, growth of this particular format and has come out with some great methods to help people, which we're going to get to in about 2 minutes. And then there's the parent, i.e. me, who has to sit there going, no, I'm trying to help my kid. I need to know what you're doing so that I can mimic it at home so that there's some sort of consistency. Because what is the largest caveat with children with ADHD?
Mm.
Lack of consistency. When
mm-hmm.
you're not consistent with the behavior, they go into a curve. They sidetail, they manipulate, they navigate, and they can totally, you know, go around the system because,
mm-hmm.
well, my teacher and the school do it this way, and I've got them 7 hours a day, and I only have you really for three, Monday
mm-hmm.
through Friday. I mean, that's really a parent's role. And you're not doing what I'm told at school, so I get to really act out. This is
mm-hmm.
so cool.
That's why, man, that communication is so important. You know, I have parents that I text regularly, like daily, to let them know, hey, this is how the day went. Don't let them tell you otherwise. It was great or it was not great, you know, or we changed this or we did this, or, you know, it's, the communication is so important because the consistency for any behavioral issue, whether it's, you know, an ADHD-like behavior or, you know, OCD, oppositional defiance, anything, you know, or just a problematic behavior that doesn't have a label to it, you know, it's that communication is so important.
All right, so I'm going to leave this to both of you, my clinical psychologist friend and my paraeducator teacher friend. I'm going to throw this out there just to be antagonistic because, well, it's a talk show and that's what I do. And you got 2 minutes. 1 minute for you, Mr. Wiener, Dr. Wiener, Warner. Sorry, I'm pronouncing your name wrong.
Yes, it's Wiener.
Thank
yeah.
you. It is Wiener, okay. And to you, Teacher Hart. So I'm going to give him the floor first, 1 minute. How much of these diagnoses is baloney versus something that is genuinely a legitimate issue?
So it's a legitimate issue that's psychology. It means a person is labeled ADHD if they do a list of behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you do the behaviors, you're labeled ADHD. It doesn't mean you have ADHD. It means you do ADHD. And then the question is, how do you
account for it? Can you say that one more time? I want you to say that one more time because it's very important.
Okay, you don't have it. It's something you do because it's a list of behaviors.
Thank you.
Okay, so if you look at the description you just gave of a kid doing ADHD and manipulative and consistency, how disabled are they if they can figure out how to self-manage all those things? So if you can self-manage well, if your parents on the phone and you're jealous, then you act up, and if your bedtime can be increased, if you're quiet, then you don't make a peep if the parents on the phone. Or if you can't organize your room, but you can organize your your army figures into intricate battle scenes. There's so many contradictions of what the kids can and can't do. So I look at in terms of understanding this is what youngsters do in response to assignments, the requirement to accommodate to expectations, what other people are requiring. And they don't do the behaviors that have to do with they initiate and enjoy the behaviors. The avoidance and intrusive behaviors don't occur. So then the question is, how do you solve it? And for me, you solve it not by permissiveness and not by coercion. It only as a last resort. You solve it by having a relationship with the child that's mutually reciprocal and acceptable, because that's what discipline is. It's helping a child learn to coordinate with others in a mutually comfortable way and learn to be as self-reliant as possible. So I developed a way to help parents learn to train their kids to be more self-reliant, so the kid isn't always, go brush your teeth, go get your coat, let me put on your hat, go get your homework. Did you remember your homework? Do you have homework today? I'm trying to get everybody out of that. Okay.
I had so many charts for Taylor. It was unbelievable. We tried every chart on the planet. If you mark this off, then you get rewards.
It doesn't work.
It was very ineffective. So I'm going to put you on pause.
Yeah.
Teacher Hart, you have 1 minute.
Yeah. So a label gets us things, right? And this was very clear to me as a college student who did ADHD and who got an identification as having ADHD, that a label got me access to things like a distraction-free room for testing or a quiet space or extra time or reduced course load. So the label got me access to what I needed, but in a perfect world, I think, under universal design and response intervention and those type of philosophies, shouldn't everybody have access to that if they need it? So I think labels get us things that we need or services or support. However, a behavior is a behavior, and, you know, is it bunk? No, a problem behavior is a problem behavior, but, you know, all of us could have problem behaviors in our life. So I really do agree with Dr. Werner. You know, it's all about, you know, do you do enough of problem behaviors in a certain way to get identified with this certain disability or this certain label? And, you know, I think that it just comes down to the fundamentals. Like, a problem behavior is a problem behavior, and how do we address it in a way that the individual feels supported, that the individual feels like they're a participating and valued member of the community? I think we need to look at it in a different way. It's not something that's intrinsically wrong with a person. It's just it's a coping skill, possibly, that doesn't work for now, that worked in the past, or it's a behavior that got them something in the past that isn't working now. It's you know, I'm very behavioral and very behaviorist in my ideas, so it's really just a matter of, you know, this pattern was repeated over time, and how can we change that pattern? And I really feel like we can do that through community by helping kids feel like they're members of a community, supported by a community. So, you know,
I think that's a perfect thing, as much as I love and adore you, but that's a perfect opening for Dr. Weiners to discuss what his methodology is. And you've got about 4 minutes to talk about, you know, coping mechanisms, what you recommend, and how do we find you? Because, you know what, I just want to run up and hug you, personally.
Thank you. You can find me, I have a website, www.craigweiner.com. It's C-R-A-I-G-W-I-E-N-E-R. And, my recent book was Parenting Your Child with ADHD, A No-Nonsense Guide for Nurturing Self-Reliance and Cooperation. And the approach I use is I try to help people use coercion as a last resort and see if you can get the youngster to buy into the kinds of things that we want the child to do, because then the child will do those things when you're not around. And I help parents try to socialize the child in a way where the child learns to figure out their own cues and their own way of negotiating the world. So you're helping the child problem solve. You're developing these executive functioning skills by the techniques I'm advising. It's a way to interrelate with the child, to increase their chances of seeing that if ADHD doesn't occur, if the child's interested, then the whole art of the therapy is how do you get the child interested in what we value and want the child to do? Because the child's not doing ADHD when they're comfortable and when the activity is associated with success and something positive, they don't have the same reactions. So the whole problem is to get the child to solve the negative responses or the anxious responses or the threatened responses that they have under certain conditions, like when the parent's not giving them attention. Or like, how do you get a child to learn to be more comfortable if the parent's busy with other people and the youngster has to learn to settle themselves down and get busy and do something on their own? So there's a whole problem of helping parents get the kid to do the teeth brushing and the dressing and how does a youngster learn to deal with their peers and share and take turns? How do you socialize a child so they learn those particular behaviors? And by the way, I agreed with every single thing your friend here said. It was wonderful what she was talking about. So I think that that's the kind of thing I'm trying to do as well in therapy with people.
So, Dr. Wiener, Sarah Hart, Dr. Wiener.
Yeah, okay.
Sarah and I actually met a couple of years ago in regards, because I'm a motivational speaker and I have a lot of friends in the area kind of thing. So I go to a lot of the events and meet people, and I bumped into Sarah and fell in love because she's just a great person, and she really, really has the right heart and the right motivation to do what she does. So I'm going to end. We have about maybe a minute before I have to completely close out the show. But what do you think is the largest message that you, Dr. Wiener, can give over 200,000 people on an international level? So you're dealing with groups of individuals that you could not have a larger spectrum, trust me. What is the one message that you would really like to convey for this show tonight?
That if your youngster's doing ADHD, that you can help them learn to stop those behaviors by paying attention to in what way those behaviors could be unwittingly reinforced as a child operates in the world. And then the alternative, the antidote for those behaviors is fostering self-reliance and then cooperation. It's not about coercing and getting submission from a child. It's about getting a child to see the joy in participating and achieving and having a relationship that's a two-way street. So that's one of the problems. Is that's the most difficult thing for all of us to do as humans, is to how do we get the intimacy and the connection with each other that has to do with the sharing and the give and take of a relationship, that we do things for each other, not for the prizes, but for the relationship and the closeness and the caring. And that's what I try to get parents to do.
So, Dr. Warner, give us your web address, because I've got about 60 seconds left of the show.
So it's www.craigwiener.com, and there you can find more about my work and easy access to the books. Books are Barnes & Noble carries the parenting book, and you can get that on Amazon or all the major booksellers. So, and there's a contact, Dr. Craig Wiener, on my website if you want to get in touch with me.
So I want to give you virtual hugs. I can't even believe where you were found in my world, but you were a perfect addition to Living and Thriving with Rusty. I'm so grateful that our paths crossed, because it's very beautiful to talk to like-minded individuals. I love it. I love this show. So my gratitude.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
All right. So, Sarah, I love you. I adore you. You're my one of my favorite true resheads in the area where we are a dying species. Many hugs to you, and thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thanks, Rusty. And thank you, Dr. Weiner.
Okay, thanks, Sarah. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Good night. So you're listening to Living and Thriving with Rusty, and this is one of the best shows we've had in a long time. Some an amazing insight, and I think so many tools to help parents and individuals who are categorized in some way, shape, or form, and sometimes disabled and sometimes enabled. And I've decided that I'm going to have Karen work on an hour show in regards to disabled parents in education to kind of discuss a little bit more deeply the pros and cons of the system and how it works or doesn't work. And I hope that Sarah gets to join us on that because, well, she's a teacher and she's pretty cool. And I hope Dr. Warner joins us on that because, well, he's a clinical psychologist and I think he can speak on levels that I cannot as of yet, soon. But I do want to let you know on Wednesday, Humpity Hump Day, my second favorite day of the week, actually used to be my first, but Sunday night's starting to rock. It's rocking out. I have Sharon Carney. She is a BFA in music. She's an author, speaker, musician, recording artist, Reiki master, consultant. She does not do dishes, but she loves chocolate just as much as I do. So we are going to have a great show on Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, here at Living and Thriving with Rusty. And we're going to talk about music on, you know, the inside and the outside of your soul, because that's what we do here. So I just want to remind you that I love you. I think you're beautiful. You are amazing. And I'm so grateful to walk this path with you. We get to walk together and learn together and so many amazing people to be with and participate with and learn about that we probably would not have had the opportunity to do so unless you were as wonderful as my assistant Karen and myself going out to find these amazing people. Until next time, take care.